Coming up on this week's show, MSX and Neo Geo games could be coming to your Switch.
A new roguelike game coming to the Mega Drive.
And we chat to Rob Cunningham of Relic all about Homeworld.
And the Retro Owl podcast is brought to you every week with our amazing friends at Bitmap Books. Now, we are loving Super Famicom, the box art collection. Now, if you're a fan of Nintendo Super Famicom, you're going to love this collection of box art chronicling the illustrations that adorned the Japanese packaging during the height of the 16-bit era. So you can check that out and the rest of their retro gaming books at bitmapbooks.com. And with our friends at PCBWay, now they're massive supporters of the retro community. And if you're working on a retro project right now, give them a try. They offer fully featured custom PCB prototyping service with low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards and services like 3D printing and injection molding. So get an instant quote for your project right now at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour Podcast, episode number 371, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to this week's show, our final one of March, well into 2023 now, and so much happening in the world of retro gaming and technology to bring you up to speed on. That's what we do on the show. Every single Friday, a brand new episode drops, and it is fair to say this show is it's a show of two halves, isn't it? We update you on what's been happening in the world of retro. And then the second half of the podcast, this is a bit we really look forward to when we welcome on a veteran of the industry to give us basically their life and career story.
Yeah. And this week we've got Rob Cunningham, and Rob worked on the series Homeworld. Now, Homeworld is one of those titles. You need to think about 1997, which was the time period that it started to develop. Ended up coming out in 1999. In that world of 1997, you know, they had not many hardware accelerated graphics cards. There was a kind of style that went with RTS and these strategy games, where a lot of them were 2D, a lot of them were flat. You know, they had mini maps in them. Well, Homeworld totally flipped that on its head and created a 3D real-time strategy. So it had a full space environment. They had, you know, memory limitations, polygon limitations, but they managed to really push it. And Rob was the art director of that. So Homeworld is absolutely fantastic, amazing. You may remember it because you may have seen some of the footage of it back in the days with that wonderful classical music and amazing soundtrack. And it was published by Sierra Studios as well. So this is all about the kind of relationship with Sierra Studios, creating that 3D RTS and that kind of standard of space games, which has gone on to, you know, many modern titles at the moment.
Well, that's the thing, Homeworld, I mean, it's still a massive franchise. I mean, Homeworld 3 is only a couple of months away now, isn't it?
That's it's about to drop. That was also delayed, but that's coming out. And you know what? They do it right when they release these titles. So I don't mind that it's been delayed, but there's been a lot of hype about it. And they've also done a remaster and a prequel recently as well.
Yeah, so it's going to be a really interesting chat. I'm just thinking, we need to ask Rob how many Voodoo graphics cards he thinks at Homeworld sold back in the day, because I imagine there's quite a lot of them flying off the shelf just for that game. So Rob Cunningham of Relic, all about the Homeworld series as early games. He'll be our special guest on the show in around half an hour from now. Now, before we jump into what's been happening in the world of retro from over the last week, we're off to Manchester. Our kid. So I should have left the impressions to Ravi.
He normally does. I can only do Liverpool.
So, well, we are excited about this because we're basically going to be going to a gaming social party. Now, this is an event that's called Format, and it's happening on Thursday, the 25th of May. Goes on until around 2 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, this is going to be quite a party. And really, the idea is that basically a bunch of people from the gaming community, retro, modern, some of the best companies in gaming as well, we all get together, have a bit of a networking event, a few drinks, a bit of a chat, and it just looks like it's going to be a nice little party, this.
Yeah, it seems to be like aimed at the kind of retro gaming scene, the modern gaming scene, but also the kind of nightlife scene. And, you know, we've started to see arcades and everything popping up all over the place at the moment. So, you know, Arcade Club UK is going to be there. There's going to be some big names as well, like Ubisoft, and it looks really exciting.
Yeah, and I know Joe's already getting ready to get his Apple Newton out to make some contacts on the night for the podcast.
You know what? I really like this because it just seems like a no-brainer. You know, it's a gaming event, which, you know, we absolutely love, but it's based around going out and the nightlife and having a few drinks, which always kind of happens when you go to these big gaming events, you know, like Play Expo and Blackpool and stuff like that. But they're actually making it, you know, as part of the part, you know, the evening part of it. So, you know, you're welcome to have a drink and get drunk and mingle with everybody and stuff like that, which I really, really love that concept. I'm surprised it's not been done sooner.
Yeah, to be fair, you know, whenever we go to events, that's always a bit I look forward to the after party, to be honest.
Yeah.
It is good that it is going to be just the after party bit. So there's going to be more than 23 game studio headliners there as well. Three floors of video games that you can play in game studios. You can meet your favourite content creators. Loads of YouTubers and Twitch streamers are going to be there. Us guys will be there. Amazing food and drink, prize giveaways. So a really good place just to kind of mingle with the community as well. And you know, whenever we go to events, we always, we're a bit cheeky. We ask for a bit of a discount for our listeners. So we've actually got you, if you want to come along to Format in Manchester, there is a 25% discount code that you can use on checkout. I'll put that in our show notes. But basically, if you enter FRM_MCR25, you'll get 25% off the ticket price. So I'll link everything you need to know up in the show notes at theretrohour.com and on your podcast app. And hopefully we'll see you there in Manchester on Thursday, 25th of May, for a couple of drinks. Right then, let's get into this week's news. Now, we keep saying whenever we talk about the Nintendo Switch, because I know Ravi's still kind of umming and erring about getting a Switch.
I've got my Wii U. I'm still pretending that's a Switch.
But yeah, I mean, it does just seem like more and more the Switch is becoming the go-to retro gaming platform. I mean, I was having a bit of a play of mine earlier on today, you know, a bunch of new Super Nintendo games on there, some more of the Game Boy Advance games have appeared in the last couple of weeks too. So there's so much retro on that platform. But it turns out there could be even more with this brand new project, which is called Egg.
Yeah, this is a... I could get this wrong, but, you know, hopefully you guys can help me along the way with this one. So Project Egg is being brought to us by D4 Enterprises, and was revealed earlier this week that they're going to be aiming to bring a lot of kind of, I don't want to say lost Japanese games, but a lot of like Japanese games that we've not really seen on modern platforms or in the West. So, you know, games from the MSX, the PC-98 and the Neo Geo, they're going to bring them under the title of Project Egg, which stands for Engrossing Game Gallery. So it's a networking, you know, like a streaming kind of service, but for old arcade games and, you know, Japanese MSX games and stuff, but on the Switch. So it kind of brings it to a newer audience and a wider audience, which I think is really cool. They've already been doing it on PC for a while, and, you know, to great success. And they have a relationship with Nintendo already because of D4 Enterprises actually brought a lot of Neo Geo games to the Virtual Console on the Wii and the Wii U, such as like Metal Slug and the Fatal Fury series and stuff like that. But it's all kind of like, it's been announced, but it's been announced that they're trying to do it. Does that make sense?
And it's in Japanese as well, the announcement, if you're trying to get the website.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's basically, it seems like the digital storefront has already been operating and is all in Japanese. So I'm guessing this is an interface for the Switch, which is going to bring it, you know, to the Western audience in the style of like AntStream or something. But the thing I love about this is these are a lot of systems, you know, that I've never played on in my life. You know, MSX, you've got the X68K, you've got the PC-88 and 98, which I've never really touched or explored those libraries. So, you know, if you sign up for this service, I'm sure you'll be able to get a huge amount of titles with it. And if it's already been established as well, I think, you know, they're probably going to have good experience of, you know, delivering this digitally and having this in a high quality with like no lag and all of those stuff. Have you tried any streaming services on the Switch yourself?
I've only tried Nintendo's own one, you know, with the which isn't really streaming. You download the games, if I remember rightly, you know, the Mega Drive games and the Super Nintendo games and stuff like that. So I've not done any sort of streaming on my Switch or anything like that. But it is a little powerhouse, you know. I've always been quite impressed with what the Switch can do. And obviously these are retro games, but, you know, if this does come to the West, I think, you know, Dan's completely right. He's hit the nail on the head. The Switch, even though it's a modern console, is just absolutely amazing for retro. It is just such a go-to retro console at the moment. And I think this will just cement it even more.
I think as well the fact that this D4 Enterprise, because originally when I saw this, I thought, is it going to be something like, because we've talked about kind of web-based kind of main platforms, you know, where you put your own ROMs and that kind of thing in there. But it looks like these are actually, you know, official, apparently they're the sole worldwide distributor of MSX Licensing Corporation.
Okay.
So, you know, it's all official and above board. And obviously they've got that track record of doing them well on the virtual console on the Wii.
Yeah, I was looking at the Wii U version, so I'm assuming those are the MSX games that were on there, and they were just perfect, you know. That was a great way to explore the library.
Yeah, cause, I mean, that's the thing. We've talked about kind of, you know, the PC Engine Mini and stuff like that, and I like mini consoles. I don't own many of them. I like the idea of them. And in fact, it was kind of like, you know, the TurboGrafx Mini and stuff like that, where they were probably going to appeal to me a bit more than something like the Mega Drive Mini, because it's a platform that I haven't played before and I'm not familiar with the, you know, these like real Japanese localized game libraries. But if they're going to end up bringing just kind of all these services to the Switch, I'm like, the Switch can kind of do it all now, can't it? You know, you don't really need to buy mini consoles.
I guess the biggest problem is going to be translation and hopefully getting that all done correctly. You know, I'm sure they will, but I can imagine if they're trying to hit, you know, a worldwide audience or different regions, they might have to translate into different languages as well. So that's going to be a big task for them to, you know, go through every single title. And maybe there's versions that they could put in that are already translated and already done.
Yeah, though, just to clarify at the moment, they haven't said it's coming to the West at all. You know, there's no kind of, they haven't revealed any plans to do that. But I think, I mean, it's often complicated doing that kind of thing because of, if they own the worldwide licensing, I guess that's going to help them a lot, because that's normally a problem, isn't it? You know, whether they can do it in different regions and make changes to the game code, like you said, then to change them into English language. But if they have the rights to do that, I mean, it would make sense. So I think there is interest because, you know, retro gaming now, I mean, I'd say I've been a retro gamer, if you like, for about, I mean, I started playing Spectrum games on my Amiga and, you know, GameCube, Game Gear games back in the late 90s and stuff. So I've probably been a retro gamer for around 25 years, you know, with a bit of a break. But I kind of feel like I've explored most of the library of systems that we got in, like, the West. So it kind of feels like I'm ready for something new that I'm totally unfamiliar with now.
And it makes sense for them to use that base of users that are already there that, you know, already have switches and that they're into that ecosystem, just, you know, address that, and then it's a goal, really. You know, they can just score straight away with that.
And it feels like a new console as well. It's cool. Cause, I mean, I love the Mega Drive games and that on the Switch, but I'm kind of at the stage now after 30 years where I could probably play Sonic the Hedgehog 2 blindfolded.
Yeah.
And that's not a challenge, Joe.
Well,
no YouTube videos coming out of that.
I know we keep saying it's a no-brainer, but the fact that they even say, you know, they want to bring these games, you know, to a new audience and a wider audience, so bringing it to the West, I think it's got to be done. But, you know, like you guys both say, it's just whether they can, you know, some of these games might not have English translations and stuff like that, so it just depends how big of an undertaking it is. But either way, even if it doesn't, I still think it's very cool, you know, bringing these kind of like obscure consoles to, you know, modern gamers.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll keep an eye on that. Project Egg, there is a video and a website in Japanese if you want to check it out, and a nice article on Nintendo Life that I'll link up in our show notes and on your podcast app as well. Head to theretrohour.com. I did talk about playing Mega Drive games over and over again, but, you know, there are, of course, new Mega Drive games that come out all the time. If you're a Mega Drive gamer, it's actually been a pretty good couple of years for new titles on that platform, and some very impressive looking games coming to the Mega Drive. And I'm going to say Ravi's favorite word now, because it does seem to be the retro gaming genre that's really in vogue right now. It is a roguelike game, Ravi, a new one that's coming to the Mega Drive, Planet B.
Yeah, it looks exciting, this one does. I like the procedural kind of random generation in there that they have, which is gonna, you know, make the game last a lot longer. It looks interesting. What do you think, Joe? I'm not really an expert in genre, as you know already.
Yeah, none of us seem to be, but it seems to be the new genre, roguelike. I think it looks cool. I think graphically they've nailed it. I mean, it's the Mega Drive. You know, you can't go too wrong with the Mega Drive, but I think graphically they've nailed it, that pixel look. And I love the soundtrack. We've only got a 45 second trailer at the moment, but it really reminded me of Echo the Dolphin, the soundtrack did. And then the look of it reminded me of the old Phantasy Star games, but it kind of meets Zelda for the Super Nintendo, A Link to the Past. That's kind of the look of it. It kind of reminded me of.
It's just a blasting the synth, like,
yeah, 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 absolutely. Kind of,
But it's got that gritty Mega Drive sound.
Yeah, it's got that gritty Mega Drive sound and that gritty Mega Drive look. There's not been much said about it, other than that it's been made by a developer called Overrated Future, which kind of sets the tone, really, because the game is set in like an apocalyptic wasteland. And, you know, it looks like you're trying to survive, and, you know, like you say, it's kind of a bit of like a dungeon crawler, randomly generated, but you're going through like derelict buildings and, you know, like the vast apocalypse wasteland by the looks of things, which is just a genre I absolutely love. If they have been answering some questions in the comments section of the YouTube page of the YouTube video they've put out, and they have confirmed it will be coming out on cartridge as well. So it will be coming to a Mega Drive cartridge, which I think is really cool. So you will be able to play that on, you know, original hardware, not through an EverDrive, which I think is really, really cool.
And they do mention as well in the trailer that it uses blast processing. That kind of pops up on the screen about 30 seconds into it as well.
Fantastic.
There's no release date announced yet, but I love the fact, you know, you said the studio called Overrated Future. It actually says in the YouTube video, available in an overrated future
nice.
For the Sega Genesis and Mega Drive. So, yeah, it looks like early days on this one at the moment. And but it just, you know, we talk about all the time how it is amazing. It seems to be like certain systems that just get so much love.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Mega Drive feels like over the last couple of years. And, you know, the Dreamcast, which we're going to be talking about next week on the podcast, kind of feels like, the Sega systems are really getting a lot of homebrew titles for them. Not so much the Saturn. I've got a feeling that might be a harder system to do homebrew for.
Yeah, probably a harder system to, you know, it was a hard system to program and develop for in the first place. Yeah. But yeah, there does seem to be a lot of love, and, you know, there's more, it's weird, like more Mega Drive and Dreamcast games coming out in the last kind of 5 years than, you know, did in the last couple of years of their kind of like life cycle. You know, I know the Mega Drive went on for a long time and the Dreamcast was kind of cut off early. But there is definitely such a huge, huge fan base for it. And it's becoming, you know, the communities of it is becoming so much more like welcoming to people trying to program for them and develop for them, it seems as well, which is really cool.
I love the fact they're making these kind of commercial quality games as well. Because, I mean, I was kind of looking before when I spotted this story, I wondered what the homebrew scene on like the Master System was like, for example. And there are a few great videos because they kind of do these game jams,
yeah,
you know, for different systems. So there's a really good video by Retro Recollections on YouTube where they've got like a 10-15 minute look at all the basically the homebrew games that were entered into this competition called SMS Power back in 2020. So none of them kind of look up to the standard of like, you know, what would have been classed as a AAA game like some of these indie studios are making. But it is cool to see that these different platforms have got their own kind of pockets of homebrew communities going on. So I think it will be nice though to see a few more kind of physical games and stuff coming out for systems like the Master System and maybe the ones that don't get quite as much love.
Yeah, that would be nice. Now you've said the Sega Saturn, I feel like that's like a rabbit hole I want to go down and just see what's out there.
Yeah. Probably loads of tweets now. What do you mean there's like 50 games come out in this year?
Yeah, probably. you guys are idiots.
So, tell us about them if so. We'd love to see them. So if you want to check out what we know about this new Mega Drive game, Planet B, I'll put a link to the trailer in the show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, while the rest of the world is getting hyped for the new Mario movie that is due out in a couple of weeks' time, I know this is going to take you back a bit, Joe.
Look at this. It's a plumber's nightmare. These pipes have been serviced for years.
Must have been a non-union job.
The original. And of course, you're going to say the best Mario movie, aren't you?
The best Mario movie. I was literally about to say that. You took the words right out of my mouth.
The best movie ever made, I think Joe would possibly say.
Quite possibly could be.
Well, it seems you're not alone in your love for the 1993 Super Mario Brothers movie that starred, of course, Bob Hoskins. And I can never say his surname, John.
Is it Lizwiowski? I can't say it.
Remember. Marion Luigi. Back in the day. But it turns out, to celebrate 30 years of the original Mario movie, while everyone else is getting hyped for the new one, there's actually a museum exhibition that's been set up to celebrate the original film.
I can't believe this hasn't been done sooner, to be perfectly honest, guys.
I know, crazy.
It's crazy.
It's an annual event.
This is great. Yeah, this is... So this is, I think, because of it, it's an American museum. In the British museums that we have, like, you know, you've got the big funded ones that have been helped by government and stuff. And then you've got all these amazing museums as well that are done by collectors. And they're fantastic to see all these retro gaming museums pop up. But I always find that the ones that kind of have a bit of government funding or stuff tend to go for like the highbrow kind of stuff. And it's a bit like, oh, we won't do a Mario exhibition. But this seems... Yeah,
more academic kind of stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it's all very academic. And I know we kind of have a bit more of a computer culture as well here, but I don't see a British museum kind of doing something like this. Maybe one of the ones set up privately would do that. But yeah, this is great. This is a really cool exhibition. And this is based in the National Video Game Museum in Frisco in Texas, which, you know, if you're in America, this is well worth a visit.
Yeah, well, this is running now. It opened on March 24th, so been open about a week when this podcast comes out as well. It is a whole exhibit celebrating 30 years of the original Mario movie. And they've actually tweeted on this Twitter account, Super Mario Brothers Inside the Pipe, kind of a few little images of what you could expect to see then. It looks like there's actually a massive selection of props from the original Mario movie.
Yeah, so they've got like the boots and the guns, and obviously they don't want to, you know, reveal too much, but by the looks of things, some of the costumes and a lot of like the posters, you know, kind of like the, you know, the media surrounding the release of it, like the promotional art and stuff like that, which looks really, really cool. I love that they have the big, massive boots, you know, that Bob Hoskins wears at one point, and the big Birdo woman wears it at one point in the film as well. I love that they've got them. But I kind of like went down the rabbit hole of SMB Inside the Pipe, and they're actually a dedicated like organization who are kind of like dedicated to the behind the scenes and highlighting the artistry of the Super Mario Brothers movie, the 1993 one.
Just the movie then they're dedicated
yeah,
to.
Like it's like right. A community who are like dedicated to the love of that movie. So, you know, maybe I need to give them a follow and maybe hit them up.
Yeah, I think this is cool. Like if you were going around and you were getting different movies and then kind of doing these exhibitions about it, I can imagine they could become touring pieces.
Mm.
So, yeah. You know, maybe they could come to the UK at one point and then a museum would like put them on. Or somewhere like the Science Museum or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's really cool. And I just wonder what other video game movies could they do? They could. The Street Fighters are going to be the obvious one, isn't it?
Mortal Kombat. The Mortal Kombat yeah. Museum.
How many? Every Resident Evil film.
Oh, God. I'd avoid that one.
Take up the whole museum.
Because as much as we kind of take the mickey out of the Super Mario Brothers movie, yeah, the original one, it was huge when it came out. And, you know, I went to see it at the cinema. You know, it was like, it was definitely part of pop culture of the early 90s. And anyone that was a Nintendo or a Mario fan went to see that film when it came out. And I know there is going to be, I just imagine Joe wants to jump on a plane just to hope that the Goomba costume's there. You just want to try it on.
I love it. We've had this ongoing joke for like 7 years. That's like my favorite film of all time. I'm not going to hop on a plane, but I think it's very cool and I think it's interesting.
Yeah. So maybe not quite worth the trip from the UK, but if you need Texas, that is available now to go and check out. So I'll link that up in our show notes as well. Now, we do love covering our computery stuff on this podcast as well as the gaming things. And this one actually looks like it could be a very powerful expansion for your Commodore 64. Now, I do love how many new expansions come out, particularly for the old Commodore machines. I mean, we had our patrons hang out on Sunday night. And ever since then, I've been trying to find one of these really souped up Amiga accelerators that a few of the guys on there were talking about. So I managed to track one of them down now. I know Ravi's quite keen as well. I'll drop you a link. But yeah, I mean, there's so many new expansions coming out all the time for retro systems. It's sometimes hard to keep up, but this one, we've kind of covered it before, but now it turns out using, of course, the power of the Raspberry Pi, which has just done wonders for retro computers. This is a really fantastic new cartridge, a full expansion for the Commodore 64 called the Radcart.
Yeah, so we did mention this before because we did a story about a Doom running on the C64, and that was using the power of the Raspberry Pi. And this is basically an expansion card, but it gives you a CPU boost, and it also emulates RAM as well, so it emulates a RAM expansion. And the way that it works is it uses a Raspberry Pi. So basically you can put any Raspberry Pi in there and it will emulate it. So the models it supports are the old 3A, 3B and 0W as well, which is one of the smaller ones. It's pretty amazing though. It could do 16 meg of RAM, which is...
For a Commodore 64 is insane.
Yeah, which is absolutely insane. And it also has MIDI support in there, which I find really interesting as well. So, you know, they've got Doom running on there, of course, as like, a proof of concept, and the machine's actually... The CPU on the Raspberry Pi is handling the power and doing all the kind of processing, and then it gets put through the C64 and displayed. I'm just wondering what other titles they could put on this. And it's nice to see as well that they've got some 3D printed cases for it, and it's kind of becoming a bit of a all-in-one product.
Well, I'm looking at this video that I'll put in our show notes as well. I'm going to see a bit more about kind of what the RAD expansion can do. It's on a YouTube channel called Emulathor, and it shows Doom running on this on the Commodore 64, and that frame rate, it is a solid 50 frames a second.
Yeah.
And I know, like you said, the Raspberry Pi is doing like the CPU horsework, but it's still pushing it through the Commodore 64's VIC-2 chip in, 16 colors, 320 by 200 pixels. Even the SID chip, the audio is coming by the SID chip as well. So I think this is a great achievement, and it looks like a really playable version of Doom that's running on this.
More playable than the Amiga version, to be honest. Yeah. Like, on an unexpanded Amiga, it's pretty insane. And I'm just thinking, like, what the capabilities are going to be like when people develop some more software to support this. Stuff like, videos being played on their YouTube. There's going to be all sorts, especially if you're got the ability to hook it up online as well. It's got no limits, this card. I think it's really interesting, and the fact that it's on sale now is fantastic. We'll drop a link for a pre-built board in the show notes.
Yeah, and I've seen people kind of doing stuff like, I think it was a 1541 Ultimate 2 card that I saw the Retro Computer guys from Leicester using once, and they were playing like movies on the Commodore 64 in 16 colors. That blew my mind when I saw that about 10 years ago. But the fact that this is using commodity hardware that's widely available, the Raspberry Pi, which, I think at one point, I wonder how many, what's going to be the most Raspberry Pis we can actually fit inside a retro machine? Because it has taken over jobs of every other chip in there now, aren't they? Which I know some people, there are purists out there that are like, it's not the same as having an original chip in there. And of course, there is no point in doing this apart from because you can.
Yeah. And also, like, it's not expensive. It's 19 euros here.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, that is a lot cheaper than, the custom expansions that I remember seeing a few years ago. Yeah. Often they get into the
that's for like the bare bones one. And then, you can get like a kind of 3D printed thing on top. And of course, you've got to get the Raspberry Pi and put it in there. But still, I think that's a bargain, for what you're getting and the power, it's crazy. I remember stuff like the Super CPU for the Commodore 64 that got really expensive back in the days.
Yeah, and even using, Pi Storm on the Amiga, where you can put a Raspberry Pi inside your Amiga 1200 or your 500 and, kind of use that as a souped up accelerator. If you were to buy an actual accelerator that could do those speeds, I mean, God, you're talking thousands of pounds.
I remember back in the day, went years ago to Nova Demo Party, and they had a guy with a BBC, and he plugged the Raspberry Pi into the BBC, and that was the first time I've been seen it used as like a co-processor. Yeah. And I was like, this is insane. And I just thought somehow in my head that it was just going to stick within the BBC world. But it's great to see all these other machines benefiting.
And even though there are the purists out there, I think, if this hardware is cheap and it's inside your machine and it feels the same, then what's the difference?
And it's fun as well. It's a fun thing to do, to be able to run that on the old machine that you love.
Yes, I've got a feeling I may be ordering one of those when we finish recording tonight, Ravi. They look very cool. Now, we did talk about Sonic Origins, of course, that collection of classic remastered old-school Sonic the Hedgehog games that came out, when was that, about a year ago now? Did Sonic Origins come out?
Yeah, it was about a year ago. I think it was last year. It might have been, was it the year before? No, I think it was last year. Summer last year.
What kind of merges into one after a while?
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Yeah.
But now there is a great new expansion as well. Well, actually, this is kind of it's a version of the game that you can either buy standalone, or for $10, you can buy an expansion for the original Sonic Origins. And this is called Sonic Origins Plus, and it adds a bunch of new Game Gear titles.
Yeah, so it's just come back to me now. It was June 23rd, because that's Sonic's birthday, and it was part of his 30th birthday celebrations, even though it was the 31-year anniversary.
The ongoing 30th party.
The ongoing 30th party. This might be part of it as well, because this comes out on June 23rd as well. Should be his 32nd birthday. But yeah, Sonic Origin Plus. So Origins Plus. So if you don't already have Origins, it'll be $40 and you'll get Origins Plus all these extra games. If you already own it, it'll be a $10 DLC. And not only does it come with all the Game Gear games, it also makes Amy playable. You know, the pink hedgehog who's, you know, Sonic's like love interest, playable in the Origin games that you already get. So Sonic 1, 2, 3, Sonic and Knuckles, and Sonic CD, which I think a lot of people were disappointed she wasn't playable in those games because of, there's a lot of like anime, you know, like they kind of like made Sonic Origins like a story that linked all four of those original games together. And Amy's like in the clips, you know, like in the cutscenes in between. And
I remember complaints that you couldn't play her, actually.
Yeah, and people complained you couldn't play as her. So she's part of this DLC. It makes her playable, which I think is very cool. And like you say, you get all the Game Gear games. And it kind of like, I knew there was a lot of Sonic Game Gear games, but I'm about to read the list out now. And it really kind of puts it into perspective. So
let me get this right, though. It's not, obviously, it's not for the Game Gear. It's for the PS5 and PS4,
yes,
and the Xbox new ones. But
it's for the Origins pack that came out last year.
But it has those games within it then.
That's correct, yeah.
Because so I was looking at this thinking, ooh, all the Game Gear games for my Game Gear. But no.
It's for modern consoles, you know, Steam and PS5 and stuff, like you say. So you spot on there to make it clear. So we kind of win at that, is that you already know what Sonic Origins was. So Sonic Origins was a pack for modern consoles, and it was a re-release, kind of like a, I don't want to say HD re-release because that's been done so many times, but they kind of like put a story in there and made it so like Tails and Knuckles was playable in all the games as well as Sonic, which I thought was like a really nice little, you know, little charm to it there. And it kind of like, you could play it in original mode, so you just play Sonic 1 and Sonic 2, or you could play it as like one big story where it just went through as one big game, which is what I did, which I thought was really cool.
And I think the idea of it was that, you know, after the movie came out, it was a way to get new fans into the old games. Yeah. That was kind of the idea behind it.
Yeah, yeah. So this Origins Plus now gives you the Game Gear game. So like I say, you get Sonic the Hedgehog, Sonic the Hedgehog 2, Sonic Chaos, Sonic the Hedgehog Triple Trouble, Sonic Labyrinth, Sonic Blast, Sonic Drift, Sonic Drift 2, Sonic 2-in-1, Tails Adventure, Tails Sky Patrol, and Sonic Spinball for the Game Gear in this new pack. So I don't know how many games that was, but it kind of puts into perspective how many Game Gear Sonic games there was. You know,
I haven't heard of half of them.
Yeah, no, I think they need to make a multi-car for the Game Gear that has them all on.
That would be a good idea. But yeah, and as well as that, you do get Amy as the playable character as well in the original Sonic games for Sonic Origins, which I think is really cool. And like I say, I think it's cool that it's only $10 if you already got Sonic Origins, and you get, what, like 8-9 games there?
It's interesting, though, because I remember when Origins came out last year, I was just before I went on holiday. I didn't actually get it, though, I don't think. I remember I was about to buy it, then I saw some quite bad reviews about it.
Yeah.
And it kind of put me off. But then since I've seen, it's been very mixed, hasn't it? I've seen some people give it like 10% and other reviews that give it 90%. So it feels like it was quite a mixed reception.
I didn't have a problem with it. I waited for it. I got it over Christmas and I got it for about £16, half price, I think it was, like, you know, as part of like the winter sale. And I thoroughly enjoyed replaying through them all. And I, for like a week every night, you know, picked up and played the next Sonic kind of thing. And I actually really enjoyed it. It was really jarring on Sonic 3 because I'm so familiar with the Sonic games that certain levels had different soundtracks, and kind of realizing how many Michael Jackson was involved with, you know, was like, I think it was, there's about 3 or 4 zones on there. I think it's the fairground level, the ski level, and then the last level. So the kind of the last 3 levels, and then a few in Sonic and Knuckles were changed as well. I don't know if that was because of the Michael Jackson thing, but that was probably my only gripe with it, because they didn't have the licenses to it, etc. But so many like reviews seem to really jump on that and really kind of stampede it as like, it's a terrible game because it's missing like 3 tracks. And you're just like,
which is beyond their control, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, Michael Jackson to stay probably owns it.
Yeah, exactly. And then also a lot of people jumping on the fact, like, how many times you're going to re-release these games or re-release them in one place, which I understand. Yeah. But, you know, as you just said, it's bringing those games to like a modern audience, and it's bringing it to like the young generation who have gone and seen the films and absolutely love Sonic now, you know, one of my best friends, his little boy who's 7 or 8, he loves Sonic 1 and 2, absolutely loves it. And he's probably never played the originals, and they have an Xbox One. So it's a good way of them, you know, of him downloading them from his son and saying, oh, look, you know, without him having to go, you know, like I say, there's loads of different ways to play it. You know, they've come out on every single console since the Mega Drive, but they've only got an Xbox One because of they're one of those families who just get the next console and give away the old one or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
And I like that it's just $10 if you've got the original, you know, Sonic Origins. You know, just $10 to upgrade, which is really good for all of those games.
Yeah, definitely.
And they upgraded them as well, you know, the new widescreen format, and it's got like, you know, some of the moves in there. I think the, was it the drop spin from Sonic Mania? I remember reading was in there too. It's kind of more modernized it for, you know, modern players, I guess, you know, that kind of removes a lot of the limitations of the original. So I'm trying to think though, did I get it? I think I may have bought it on my Switch, just never played it or something. I don't know. I'm going to have a look. It wouldn't surprise me if I'd done that. Because we were talking the other day when I came around Joe's house. I've still got games from the PlayStation 3 that are in their shrink wrap that I haven't played yet.
That's just being an adult. It's just, you know, life gets in the way. I've had Resident Evil 4 since Friday. We're now on, what day is it, Tuesday? And you know me, massive Resident Evil fan. And I mean, I've played it. Don't get me wrong. I've stayed up playing it late, but I'm nowhere near completing it. And I'm just like, what's happened to me?
When you're a teenager, you'd have finished it on the first day.
Yeah, well, even as an adult, you know, on the last remakes, I finished them in the first day, but it hasn't happened this time. But I think it's just, you know, the passage of time, you know, other things get in the way, unfortunately. But yeah, I would not be surprised if you've probably already got Origins Plus downloaded down. It's not out until June 23rd.
So it might spur me to give it a play if I have bought it already. So yeah, if you do want to get that, I'll link that up. And of course, everything else we talk about, you find them all in our show notes. You don't have to Google around or anything. Just check your podcast app or head to theretrohour.com. Just quickly before we get into our chat with Rob Cunningham, this week's special guest, just a quick reminder that theretrohour.com is also the place that you can head to if you would like to join our wonderful patrons community. Now, we did have our most recent hangout the weekend just gone, so there is another one of those coming up in a couple of weeks' time, end of the month. We do it last Sunday of every month, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m. UK time. Luckily, even though the clocks changed in the early hours of Sunday morning, and I completely didn't realise that my missus woke me up and it was like 11 o'clock.
It's all automatic now. I always have one clock in the house that isn't, and it's usually the oven. And
mine was the oven.
Out of date for like half a year.
I was like, why have I slept in so late? She goes, the clock's going forward. I'm like, oh, right, didn't realise. But luckily, everyone did make it onto the patrons hangout in time. We had a great little chat this weekend. A few new faces that joined us too. We talked about all kinds of stuff on the hangout. I mean, the subjects are so varied now, aren't they?
Yeah, we ended up talking about South Park and ChatGPT, which was really interesting. We were all kind of giving our thoughts on that and stuff. And of course, showing off our retro collections and talking about retro games and stuff like that. But we always end up, you know, kind of like down different rabbit holes and stuff like that, or end up on just tech in general or films. And I was really worried as well, you know, about the time change, because only about 5-6 people jumped on, you know, when we first kind of booted it up at 8 o'clock. But within 5-10 minutes, you know, there's 30-40 people on there, which just absolutely blows my mind that, you know, people not only support the show, but then want to come on and chat with us and stuff like that and get involved in the community. So, and, you know, it has a real community culture to it now, which I absolutely love.
Yeah, new people are welcome all the time. I mean, we had a few new faces. Pretty much every hangout we get a bunch of new people coming on for the first time. And it's a really welcoming community. So we'd love to see you there. If you join us on Patreon, of course, you're going to get an invite to it at the end of April. And for our gold members and above, we've actually just recorded possibly the most controversial episode of our bonus podcast, The Retro Hour After Hours, episode 33, where... we went all piratey on you. Arr.
Yeah. We were discussing piracy throughout the ages. And it was interesting. I had to watch myself so I didn't incriminate myself.
Ravi hasn't got to jail yet. Yeah,
it was really good, though, all of our different experiences and also all the different formats and quite a few interesting debate points about, like, did Napster help lead to iTunes? And, you know, there's a lot of interesting conversations you can have around piracy.
Yeah, we talked about, you know, even stuff like cart to floppy copiers on the Super Nintendo and the Mega Drive, X copy on the Amiga, IRC. Market stalls and stuff back in the day. So it was about an hour and a half discussion All about piracy, a lot of our memories about it as well. Like Robbie said, quite a bit of debate in there too. We all had, you know, some varying opinions on stuff, so it was a really interesting episode. And if you join us as a gold member or above, you can not only get the latest episode, but you'll unlock the previous 32 episodes of the After Hours as well. So lots of listening there. And of course, the main reason that you're joining us on Patreon is that just to support this podcast and make sure that we can keep bringing out new episodes every single Friday. So thank you so much for your support. Right, then next, going inside Homeworld with this week's special guest, Rob Cunningham. He's coming up next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guest. And we're so excited to talk to our guest this week, an original founding member of Relic Entertainment, the art director for the cult classic Homeworld as well. Let's welcome on Rob Cunningham. How are you doing, Rob?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you, sir?
Very good, thank you. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. We're really excited to hear some of your stories about your many experiences in the industry. But kind of taking it, you know, back to day one, I mean, let's go all the way back. What kind of got you into gaming originally then? Do you remember where it all started, your first ever experience of video games?
I do, yeah. You know, to be honest, it was, let's see, 96. And I was a freelance artist at the time, working out of Vancouver. And, you know, could barely make rent and, you know, typical, you know, 20-something story. And I was teaching at a school for animation and video game programming called DigiPen back in the day. And one of my students was Alex Garden, who wasn't much younger than me. I mean, we were all quite young at the time. And one day he literally just came up and said, hey, do you want to start a video game company with me? And I was like, sure, you know, why not? So me and Alex and the four other guys got together and started Relic Entertainment, and it sort of took off, and it was pretty life-changing for all of us at that time.
Were you a games player yourself? Were you a video gamer before that?
Well, you know, sort of, but you got to remember it was early mid-90s, so, you know, video games were sort of crap at the time, you know. I mean, they were all right. There were some cool ones. I remember playing Command & Conquer and Red Alert and, you know, watching other people play Doom because, you know, the mad 3D environment would sort of make me nauseous. But yeah, you know, I was sort of into it, but not you know, crazy about it.
I was watching an interview with you, and you mentioned that you'd worked on an RTS title previously, which you could kind of see through buildings on that one. What was that title?
Yeah, so that was a short-term gig I had just before Alex and me and the guys started Relic. It was, you know, I was working with those guys for a couple of months that summer. And yeah, I mean, it was pretty much the same as Command & Conquer, only the buildings were a bit bigger. You know, the little sprites for the buildings were a bit bigger. And when you sent units into the buildings, the roof would sort of disappear and you'd see guys, you know, working at consoles and stuff. It was pretty cool. But
what was that called?
That was a company called Fearless Games. And I can't even remember. I don't think it even had a title at the time.
Oh, wow.
It was never released.
Well, what got you into art and drawing, and like who were your kind of influences and inspiration?
Wow, yeah. So, well, I've always been into drawing since I can remember, and you know, I always loved the work of, you know, Sid Mead and the artists in the Star Wars franchise, the storyboard artists, the pre-production artists, and I was really drawn to that kind of illustration and conceptual art as opposed to fine art. And so, you know, in my, you know, I guess early 20s, I thought to myself, well, you know, I love drawing and I love, you know, making pictures and drawing spaceships and, you know, stuff like that. And I love these movies that have this great sort of, you know, futuristic visualization or art direction. And you know, so at the time I thought, you know, I got to get into movies. I got to start doing storyboards and, you know, get into, you know, film pre-production visualization. And then that sort of, you know, brought me to Vancouver and led me sort of by accident really into the video game business.
I think it was pretty crazy. You know, you mentioned that your students had actually asked you about, you know, founding Relic and like creating a company. How quickly did that, you know, turn into an actual company? And what was the kind of like turnaround like? Were you working collaboratively before, or had you not even worked together?
The founding group of Relic had never worked together, but as a group, I think Alex and Luke had worked together, and I think Alex and Aaron Cambitz had worked together, and Aaron Daly. So I think, you know, we'd sort of, you know, they had worked together, you know, here and there, I think at Radical and EA. But as a group, we had never done anything together before. Indeed, when Alex said, hey, let's start this company, I think we all went to his place for pizza on a Friday and met for the first time. And then it was like a week later or something, we were all heading down to Seattle to pitch the Homeworld concept to Scott Lynch, who was at Sierra at the time. And yeah, I mean, it was a Saturday. There was no one there. Scott was supposed to have a partner there, but he couldn't show up. So we were all thinking, you know, that's not going to happen. Then we went into the pitch and, you know, Alex was, you know, making sound effects with his mouth and like wiggling his hands around, doing the spaghetti ball, you know, pitching Homeworld. And we showed him a bunch of art. Me and Aaron Cambitz showed him a bunch of art that we had done for previous stuff. And the pitch was over, and we were sort of standing around in the parking lot, and Scott gave Alex a ring and said, you guys are greenlit. Let's make this game. So, you know, wow. It was sort of amazing. And then I think about, you know, like a month later, we had a bunch of money and rented an office above a nightclub in Vancouver. And next thing you know, we're making Homeworld.
That must have been quite the ride, you know, that just all that happening in a couple of weeks' time.
Oh, it was mad.
Were you aware of Sierra Studios' history, and how did you kind of approach them then? How did they get on your radar?
Well, Alex knew Scott from before. I can't remember. I don't remember how he knew him. I think he did a gig at EA for a bit, and I think Alex was sort of friends with Don Matrick at the time, and I can't remember what the connection was there, but he knew Scott, and I'd never heard of Sierra. So, yeah, it was pretty sudden. It was pretty crazy.
I read that you were kind of doing sketches in the car on the way there and stuff. And
yeah, well, we weren't actually sketching in the car, but we were showing each other's drawings. Like me and Aaron Cambitz drove down together. I was driving and literally showing each other our art for the first time. I'd never seen his art before, and he'd never seen mine. And, you know, we're heading south on the 99 and Interstate 5 down into Washington State, like handing paper back and forth while I'm trying to drive. And I just was blown away. I mean, the guy is an incredible artist. And I just thought, my God, you know, this guy is just awesome. I can't wait to, you know, work with this guy. So, yeah, we weren't actually drawing in the car while it was moving.
Yeah, that'd be quite difficult.
On a stable surface.
It was tricky enough just looking at pictures while driving. Yeah.
I was wondering when the idea of Homeworld actually then came together. Was it in the meeting, or was it something you'd discussed before? Or?
Well, I think Alex had brainstormed the idea of a 3D RTS in space, you know, like a sci-fi RTS in space. There was sort of a mashup of Command and Conquer play mechanics with a sort of Battlestar Galactica story-ish. And a sort of, you know, Star Wars cinematic quality. And, you know, that all sounded awesome. You got to remember as well, this is like 1996. So, you know, nothing like that was even remotely out there. And I can't remember where the idea came from at first. I think Alex had brainstormed it with a friend of his. I think it might have been Greg McMartin. I can't remember. But, you know, he still had this idea in his head, and that's pretty much how he pitched it to us all. You know, he was like, it's Command and Conquer meets Battlestar Galactica. And then he'd do the hand wiggling and, you know, sound effects, and we'd all be fully on board, you know.
Because for the RTS genre, there was stuff like Dune before and a few previous titles, and then like Supreme Commander as well was one that was kind of out at the time. But you're right, there was nothing set in space or in that kind of sci-fi world.
Yeah, I mean, the big idea, you know, the big innovation was this, was, you know, being in space, we didn't have to deal with terrain. We didn't have to deal with a you know, a surface, which was super exciting to us, but also mega challenging. So we had this crazy camera we had to design and implement. But yeah, you're right. I mean, there were a couple of games. Obviously, Dune 2 was before that, and, you know, Command & Conquer and Red Alert, Supreme Commander, you know, but all of them were very much... I think Supreme Commander might have actually been 3D, technically, but there was nothing like the 3D sort of mad zoomy orbital camera that Homeworld had.
Obviously, 3D graphics were, you know, the really, really cool thing back then. You know, I remember people rushing out to buy graphics cards just to play games like Homeworld.
Yeah.
You know, other games around the time, they were actually selling hardware. I mean, what were kind of the struggles to add that extra dimension in an RTS game, you know, going from what was traditionally a 2D genre to the third dimension?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, you know, in those days, I mean, Homeworld came out in 99, in September of 99, and we shipped the game with a software version and a hardware version. So, you know, the software version was just utterly crap. I mean, and even, you know, you would need a pretty decent machine in those days to run Homeworld. So, you know, it really pushed the machines to its limits. But in terms of design, the biggest issue we really had to solve for was the fact that it was 3D and in space. So Aaron Daly, who's the lead designer, you know, came up with this awesome camera model involving selecting ships and focusing on selection sets and being able to rotate, and, you know, at the poles the camera would lock so that you wouldn't get, you know, inverted and disoriented. And, you know, in a nutshell, I mean, the full answer is very lengthy and detailed, but in a nutshell, we were trying to solve for all of the problems that a player would face in a 3D space environment. So, you know, orientation, you know, visibility, unit identification at a distance, being able to make sense of the combat that was happening. So we had to come up with all sorts of systems to support that and, you know, give player visual and audio feedback that so they wouldn't be, you know, totally lost or confused. We had to implement a map system. So at the time, RTS has had this little mini map in the corner of the screen that would be, you know, with the little pixels of all, you know, and you could move around on that. And, you know, we tried that, but it was a disaster. You couldn't make any sense of it because, for a start, everything's in 3D. But one of the big things we wanted to do with Homeworld, which at the time was a big innovation, was a scale representation that was sort of vaguely accurate. I mean, it was still utterly fake, but we wanted the small ships to sort of believably come from the belly of the big ships. So, you know, RTSs at the time, you'd have a tank that would come out of a tank factory, and, you know, a tank factory wouldn't be a lot bigger than the tank. So, you know, it was very sort of, you know, abstracted. It was still fun and everything and looked cool, but it felt very abstracted, and we wanted it much more like Star Wars, you know, with TIE fighters spewing forth from the belly of a destroyer kind of vibe. And, you know, to pull that off, we had to, you know, create quite extreme scale representation. So, you know, that was another big issue we had to tackle. So, you know, altogether, there was quite a bit of, you know, challenges to pull off a 3D space combat experience that wasn't an utter confusing disaster.
I remember a lot of titles going from 2D to 3D, and you're right, the camera angle was always the really frustrating part about it for the player, and having those that kind of full orbit on the camera and the way that it could lock into ships as well was really, really important for Homeworld.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine, like, you know, I mean, it's an incredibly fluid and dynamic environment that you're in there as a player. You know, you're looking through this window, which is, of course, your monitor, at a world that is in just absolute turmoil. You've got, you know, because with Homeworld, you'd build a bunch of ships, you'd organize them in formations or a fleet, send them forth across the void. The enemy is approaching from the other direction, and then as soon as they make contact, it's just mayhem, you know, on the screen. Guys are going left and right and up and down and weaving between each other, and, you know, if you got a lot of problems there that you got to solve for. So,
well, how did the need for users to recognize units from distance and all the angles play into the design of the ships themselves in the game?
Yeah, so it was so when Aaron Daly came up with the fleet, you know, specs, the breakdown of ships, it was really important for the two main factions to sort of match one another conceptually, right? Like a destroyer is a destroyer, a frigate's a frigate, a fighter's a fighter, kind of on both sides. But we wanted them to look as different and as distinctive as possible so that when you're looking through the screen at this mad sort of maelstrom of space combat, yeah, absolutely anything we could possibly do to help you out make sense of this mess, we would do. So, you know, we implemented these long engine trails that came out the back of the ship so that you could tell where they were and where they were going and where they'd been. That also created this cool sort of smoke in the air, sort of air show thing, which was very cool. Different colored engine trails, but the ships themselves had to have very clear and distinctive silhouettes so that you could make positive ID on the ships at whatever distance. You know, so the Taidan fleet, for example, were brightly colored red and yellow striping, which was easy to see from quite some distance. And they also had like big wings sticking off them here and there and so on and so forth. So we really took pains to sort of design and test the visual silhouette to make sure that they looked different. Like if you took a MiG fighter and an F-15 or whatever, they look pretty similar, you know? And if you zoom out, you really can't tell the difference between them. And we didn't want that. We wanted it to be clear that, you know, a Taidan fighter looked definitely different in as many ways as we possibly could to a Kushan.
Especially on a 17-inch CRT monitor, I imagine.
Absolutely, you know, yeah. Running in software.
That's kind of like, you know, you built them for necessity so that the users could recognize them and they work well. And then they became iconic pieces in their own right.
Yeah, I mean, it was really, I should say, really kind of rewarding for me and Aaron Cambitz to see, you know, how well the ship designs were received by people and the sort of longevity of those styles and those designs. We were really inspired by the artists, the sort of sci-fi book cover artists from the 70s and 80s, you know, like, you know, Peter Elson, Chris Foss, John Harris, these guys, they do these spectacular paintings, you know, of brightly colored ships covered in pageantry and stuff. And, you know, and then after Star Wars came along, you know, all of the ships in Star Wars were pretty much gray. You know, they didn't have a lot of color on them. I mean, they were all obviously awesome, like iconic, but very, very gray. And we knew that if the, you know, and same deal with Battlestar Galactica and so on. So, you know, at the time we were inspired by these ship designs and the look and feel of those franchises. But we knew that because Homeworld was a game, if everything was gray, you would be struggling, you know, to make sense of anything. So we were inspired by these guys, these artists from the past, and really sort of channeled their look and feel to sort of create these splashy ships that were very brightly colored, covered in decals and, you know, and very realistic, you know, very, perhaps not realistic because they're still sci-fi fantasy, but you know what I mean? Like very plausible.
And graphically beautiful as well. I mean, I'm quite interested in terms of the software and the hardware that was used for making them. I mean, what kind of 3D programs and hardware were you using for the rendering and the design of them?
I think we were using Lightwave. Yeah, I think it was Lightwave. And, you know, we were just drawing. I mean, in terms of designing them, we would literally just draw them with pen on paper, then scan the drawings and load them up in Photoshop and like hand paint the paintings using mice, you know, using the mouse in Photoshop because there was no Cintiqs or anything back then. And then just, you know, hand bomb them in Lightwave and then, you know, texture them up. So, you know, there really wasn't a very, you know, there was no off-the-shelf package for any of that stuff back then.
Well, you mentioned the kind of accuracy of the scaling and making sure everything was in the right perspective. I do remember a lot of the older RTSs would have, you know, like huge humans or, you know, massive dogs stuff like that. And it was all out of proportion. Did you think people really appreciated the realism?
Yeah, I think so. I think it just made the ships, you know, I think you could relate more to them. You know, one of the things we knew because we weren't going to have characters was we knew that the ships themselves would be the characters in the game. So, you know, the more character they had, the, you know, the cooler they looked, the more distinctive they looked, the way they sounded, you know, the audio of the game. It was a classic case of, you know, being an artist within extremely tight constraints. So, you know, often when you've got a creative challenge and incredibly tight constraints, you're often successful because you're working within very clear lines. You've got to make it work. So, yeah.
We kind of touched on already, you know, the fact that hardware accelerated 3D graphics cards were kind of coming in, but not really standard for everyone. You know, Voodoo cards and stuff were still quite expensive then. I mean, how did you kind of keep within the polygon and memory count then? Was that kind of a balancing act?
Oh my God. balancing act, I'd say, is a very, very, you know, nice way of saying it. It was more like a hair on fire, mad freak out that lasted like two or three years. You know, the way we dealt with that was we had extremely limited poly and texture budgets to work with. So, you know, we would have to design these ships in a way that could be modeled with very limited, you know, polygons, you know, which is actually kind of interesting because, you know, I remember like reading something somewhere about the design of the, you know, some of the ships in Star Wars, particularly the big ships, you know, like the Star Destroyers were these giant, you know, triangular shaped things because it was relatively easy to build them. You know, you could just build massive sheets of wood and, you know, plywood and sort of screw them together and then cover them in detail. It was much the same for us back in the day in Homeworld. You know, we had to, you know, hand bomb these polygons into shape, and every ship had a very limited polygon budget. And then as you zoomed out, we had to go through, you know, procedural scaling to, you know, well, it wasn't procedural actually at the time. We had to hand bomb each level of detail as the ship got smaller on screen and further away from the camera. So yeah, the texture budget was a really big issue. We had, I forget what the budget was for the whole game, but it was laughable compared to modern games. And Aaron Kambitz came up with this incredible method of squeezing detail into pixels. You just couldn't believe it. Like, I think he called it the sub-pixel detailing method or something. Where, you know, by some miracle, he was able to, you know, put colored pixels next to one another, and, you know, miraculously articulate detail that just didn't exist in the texture. So, you know, you want to make a hole in the side of the ship, and there's a little highlight on one edge and a little shadow on the other, and it's literally like two pixels that are holding that information, and inside there's just sort of like four pixels that are slightly different colored gray, but from the right distance, it looks like there's some, you know, like a little carburetor or something in there, you know, and your mind does all the work. So again, you know, massive props to Aaron Kambitz for, you know, coming up with how we did this.
Well, it's clear from, you know, what you're telling us so far, the amount of work and dedication that went into making the game. And it was, so you mentioned that you moved into an office above a nightclub, and
yeah,
you know, I imagine that the game was originally meant to take a year and it ended up taking 3 years.
Yeah.
I mean, what was kind of the culture like there then? And were you guys, I heard people like staying 24 hours a day in the office sometimes. Tell us a bit about what the kind of the culture was like at that time.
It was kind of crazy, you know. I mean, we were all in our 20s. It was our first big proper gig. We were on our own. We were, you know, so yeah, people slept at the office all the time, you know. We'd be working day and night. The nightclub would rage until whatever in the morning, and we were smoking heaps of weed, you know, or some of us were.
Yeah.
A lot of fun. It was very stressful, but the team chemistry we had was really fantastic, and everybody really got along and everybody worked really hard. And there was this sort of fantastic sort of, I don't know how you would describe it. I guess like a meritocracy where every time someone did something awesome, it would just inspire everyone else to do something awesome in return. And so there was this sort of positive cycle of achievements that were happening sort of routinely. And you know, of course, on the personal side, you know, it was a disaster. You know, everyone's girlfriends left them. You know, no one saw anyone from their family for ages. Everyone was wondering if we were all still alive, you know. but you know, we were all in our early mid-20s, and, you know, and this was our big thing. So we all knew that you know, we just couldn't cock this up. This had to be good.
Well, one thing that really stood out for me was the music in Homeworld, and it kind of had that epic, that space epic feel, and but you know, like a space odyssey to me. Where did that kind of classical music idea come from, and how did it develop?
Well, the theme song of the game came to Alex one morning by way of his alarm clock radio, where he woke up to the song playing on the radio, and it was the Agnes Day song by Samuel Barber. And he immediately knew that this was going to be the theme song of the game, because it had this sort of epic sense of longing, and you know, it was just perfect. So he played it for us, and we're all like, that's definitely the theme song. And as for the rest of the score of the game, that was entirely created by Paul Ruskay over at Studio X in Vancouver. And I mean, I don't know how Paul does his thing, but we were just creating these environments and the ships. We had the story coming together, and then we started making all the backgrounds and the lighting for the game, and this sort of, you know, epic galaxy quest, you know, galaxy voyage, space voyage was starting to come together. And then Paul just printed out screenshots of all the locations and taped them to the wall of his music studio in a row. So he had the entire campaign of the game sort of sitting there on his wall in front of him. And he just started cranking out the music, just all of these, you know, ambient tracks, one after the other, to really set the tone and the feel for each location. And then, you know, scoring all of the cinematics as well. So, you know, the amazing thing about what was being done at that time, and I've said this before, but it's worth repeating, is when it came to finaling Homeworld, there was no time for iteration at all. Mm. So the first version of everything we made, you know, with a couple of exceptions, but really not many, you know, was the thing that shipped with the game. So, yeah. You know, when it came to the, you know, the cinematics, that, you know, animatics, Aaron just drew and animated them and then rendered them, and they were done. And then he'd hand them over to Paul, and Paul would just put audio to them, and they were done. You know, with the backgrounds, I would just make one background after the other, and that was it. That was the background that was shipping with the game, and so on and so forth. So it was sort of amazing. It all happened really very quickly in the last year of production, and really, you know, intensely in the last 6 months of production. This beautiful sort of carpet of interactive experience just started sort of appearing in front of all of us. And it was magic. It was really quite magic. Every time someone would add something to the build, you know, we'd all play it and just be amazed and delighted. It was really quite a shocking. I don't think any of us had experienced anything like that at the time.
Yeah, it definitely feels like stuff was going at a pretty intense pace, and, you know, the project growing rapidly as well. And there's one point of note, you know, kind of following on from the audio there as well, because, you know, my mum was a bit of a prog rocker back in the day. And I know you had, I remember listening to, like, you know, Owner of a Lonely Heart when I was a kid by the band Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And they actually did a song called Today for the soundtrack of Homeworld. So how did that come about then? And did you guys get to meet them?
Yeah, so I haven't, okay, so I might be wrong here, but if I'm not mistaken, what happened was we were just about finished with the game, and we had released a beta to a bunch of people to play. And allegedly, I think the bass guitarist from the band was one of the beta testers, because he was a, you know, sci-fi fan or something, or a gamer fan or whatever. And, right. You know, just thought it was awesome and shared it with the band. And they wrote that song, Our Home Is Our World, or whatever was that, you know, that song. And they reached out to Sierra to tell them that, you know, that they had made this, they loved this game that we were working on, and they made this song. And Sierra thought it would be really cool to get the you know, to get the song in the game, because Yes was like a 70s super band and the art of the game was inspired by these 70s artists. So, you know, they thought it was a good connection. And I was like, yeah, right on. I mean, I was never a Yes fan, but I thought, yeah, right on. Let, you know, chuck it in there. That sounds awesome. You know, let's have it. I remember, I don't know if Alex was too keen on it. I remember him thinking, well, Yes was a band from, you know, decades ago. What's the relevance today? And, you know, but whatever, you know, it's like, it's a, these guys are rock stars. Let's get them in the game. So yeah, we met them. There was I think the release party was held in LA, and there was some sort of press meeting that happened in a restaurant. You know, we were all down there, and then apparently John, the lead singer from the band, wanted to talk to me. And so, you know, these marketing people came rushing up to me, and they were all, you know, in a panic saying, you know, John wants to talk to you. You got to get over there. And so I was like, okay. And I sat down at the table, and he was going on about wanting to, you know, do some tour. It was a real sort of, you know, rock star moment where he was like, this dude was going on about, you know, creating giant spaceships to float above the stadium in like hot air balloons or something, or on cables. And then he got out a pen and started just drawing his vision of a homeworld experience in a stadium on the tablecloth of the restaurant, like actually on the actual cloth. And, you know, these photographers all got in a frenzy and started taking pics. And I remember just thinking, you know, this is awesome. This is never going to happen, but I'm loving this moment right now. And yeah, we hung out with the band and, you know, and partied with them. It was pretty fun.
That sounds awesome. Sierra, we used to know them for huge adventure games, and they were very like story driven. And you guys have created this wonderful, you know, technical achievement. And what point did the narrative kind of get in there and the story around it like get created?
Well, we knew, I mean, the game was called Homeworld. So we knew that it was something about, you know, getting to your homeworld. But the story itself didn't really start coming together until, I guess, about halfway through production, when we had gotten extensions and budget extensions from Sierra and had realized that, you know, that we could never tell any kind of story unless we had some sort of pre-rendered cutscenes. And so, you know, they gave us a bunch more money to make this and more time to make all this stuff. And we got Martin Cyrillis to bang out a script, which was, I think Dave Williams was he's an old mate of mine from school. You know, he was a writer and he came up with he was also a historian, like he studied history. And I was like, hey, Dave, you know, could you help us out? You're a military historian. You know, like, we've got this game. It's called Homeworld. It's about going home. You know, can you give us a hand here? And I think Dave came up with the basic premise, which was the Exodus story, right? Like, you know, something happened in the distant past and your people were sent into exile and, you know, far, far away across the galaxy. And you were sort of marooned on this hostile desert planet and abandoned for millennia. And the people had, you know, suffered some sort of collective cultural amnesia and had no idea where they were from. So it was really we all thought it was a cool mashup of sort of, you know, historical. It sort of tasted like, you know, the Jewish Exodus or something. You know, they had a cool sort of historical flavor, but also a very sort of relatable sort of teenage angst problem where you've got sort of like an identity crisis and your home doesn't really feel like home. And, you know, you've got this, you know, destiny that you're supposed to, you know, fulfill or be somewhere. But that's all we had. And then Martin Cyrillis fleshed that out into a very rich script, which we then, you know, edited down into something that we could produce. And then, like I said, it was the version that we shipped like version 2.5 of the script or something. Like it was pretty pretty much straight out the door. I remember at the time thinking, you know, feeling kind of embarrassed because we all thought that we were making a game for our peers or even people older than us. And that they would find the story sort of too cartoonish or comic booky, you know, and a bit silly. But it turned out that, you know, the people who loved the game the most and that were playing the game the most were kids that were way younger than us, you know. So we shipped the game when we were all sort of, I think, you know, 25 to 29 years old. But all of our key, you know, all of the players, all of the people who became fans were at the time, you know, between 8 and 12 years old or 13 or whatever, right? Like much, you know, solid younger than us. And, you know, and they just totally connected with it. You know, we got all this feedback afterwards from people saying, like, you know, I cried, it changed my life.
You know, like, it was one of the biggest things that fans really, really invested in and got into that whole storyline and world. And, you know, it's kind of gone throughout the series as well, which is absolutely fantastic. Yeah, it's a great achievement to have that kind of, you know, you're fighting for something or you're trying to...
Yeah,
you know, find your home world, but you're kind of like the outcast as well, or the underdog.
Yeah, you know, and then when it turns out that, you know, you can imagine the sort of, you know, teenaged angst or pre-teenaged angst happening with these kids that are playing the game and the story, which is all about, you know, you've been shafted and you're in the wrong place and it's not your home. And there's this whole question of origin and where are you from and who are you? And then when it turns out that there's some big bad enemy that sort of shafted you in the past and, you know, there's this whole revenge thing happening because they come and kill everybody. There's nobody left but you and your mothership. And so you've got this sort of axe to grind and you know, I think a lot of people sort of connected with the story on a personal level, you know, which we didn't expect at all.
Well, how did you represent the fog of war to the users?
Yeah, so Fog of War was and is a sort of RTS staple. And the way we did it was in we used the render list, which was the distance from the camera that ships could be drawn, and combined it with the what we call blue blobs or the spheres in the Sensors Manager map. So in the map of the game, when you zoomed out to map, you know, to map mode, all of the, you know, fog of wars were represented as blue spheres, semi-transparent blue spheres in this mode. And if there was an enemy unit around, it was only visible if it was within the fog of war or visibility sphere of one of your units. So, you know, and then it would appear as a red dot in this sort of air traffic control radar screen type view, only, you know, obviously in 3D. So, yeah, so that's how we did it. So the gameplay was all about, you know, sneaking around in the space between spheres.
I was wondering when you got onto Homeworld 2 as well, there was a huge multiplayer aspect on that. What were the considerations needed when you were doing a multiplayer kind of section of the game?
Well, I'm sure if you were talking to Luke, he could tell you all about the technical issues there. But from a gameplay design perspective, the multiplayer game, you know, one of the things, you know, it obviously it's a multiplayer RTS. So you've got a map with a bunch of players in various corners of the map fighting over limited resources and then duking out in a big battle. So all of the sort of classic multiplayer issues, you know, faced us twos, you know, such as comeback mechanisms. You know, if you start losing a game like that, you know, it's just a question of how quickly do you lose. You can't really come back and fight. So we're implementing all sorts of things to sort of, you know, help with that, like, you know, being able to hyperspace around the map and transferring command from a mothership to a carrier if your mothership died, and, you know, stuff like that, which was only featured in the multiplayer game. So, you know, I don't remember too much in the way of multiplayer specific issues or challenges that we faced, other than, like I said, these sort of, you know, the expected stuff. I was never terribly good at playing Homeworld. I always got my ass kicked in the office. But
well, another thing that's really important with an RTS is resources. And, you know, in Command and Conquer, you've got Tiberium. Where did the idea of like salvaging ships come from and having a salvage team?
Well, Aaron Daly came up with the the entirety of the resource model. And we wanted there to be multiple ways to collect resources in the game. So you had your natural resources, which were asteroids and nebula. And you had, but we wanted there to be something that was associated with, enemy units. So Aaron Daly came up with the salvage mechanism, which was implemented as corvettes that would look like little tugboats. And, you know, if you got enough salvage corvettes attached to an enemy ship, you could steal that ship and integrate it into your fleet. So, you know, it was a really cool mechanic in the game. I don't think we tuned it very well, so I think it ended up being a bit of an exploit in the single player game. But it worked pretty well, and it was a lot of fun. It was super satisfying to steal the other guy's stuff.
Yeah, and a lot of the time it was the kind of quickest way of, you know, improving and getting your fleet a lot bigger.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean by not tuning it super well.
Well, back in, I think it was around 2015, wasn't it, when Homeworld got a remaster?
Yeah.
And that was very well received. I mean, you know, looking at that, what kind of improvements in that were you most proud of?
When Gearbox acquired the IP from THQ's bankruptcy proceedings, I guess that would have been like 2013 when that went down. I immediately reached out to them and congratulated them on the purchase and told them, hey, you know, we got this new studio called Blackbird and we're working on this ground-based desert, you know, RTS quasi-RTS that, you know, very much looks and, you know, sort of feels like Homeworld. We should talk. So that's when we made the deal to create Deserts of Karak as a prequel to Homeworld 1. And at the same time, they were working on remastering the original two titles. So they came to us and said, hey, you know, you guys made this thing, you know, could you, you know, because the Blackbird team had a bunch of people, old school people from Relic at the time who had worked on Homeworld, including Aaron Cambitz and myself and so on. So they contracted us in a sort of advisory capacity to help them remaster the original two titles. So Gearbox deserve all of the high fives for the quality of the remaster itself. The ex-Relic, ex-Homeworld Blackbird team provided all of the backgrounds to the remastered games and all of the remastered animatics. We helped out a little bit with the art direction too, you know, on the ships and so on, and what they should look like. But it was very much handled by the internal Gearbox team, and they did a really fantastic job. We were in touch with them like literally all the time, so it felt very much like a collaboration. But yeah, they did a really fantastic job there.
And I imagine having you guys involved as well was, you know, really helped, because, you know, remastering something, particularly something that people are very passionate about, it can always be a dangerous kind of thing, so you don't want to get it wrong. So
yeah, exactly.
I guess having you guys advising them really helped.
At the time, Gearbox's creative officer was Brian Martell, who is himself a huge sci-fi fan. So Brian was the art director on, you know, Borderlands and is a extremely gifted art director and art enthusiast. So he was the sort of, you know, drive behind acquiring the IP and the remastering of the game. So you know, and we were in contact with him through Deserts of Karak, and so we very much, it was sort of me and Brian Martell that were sort of the contact points. Brian representing Gearbox and myself representing Blackbird. And we kind of built Deserts of Karak and Homeworld 1 and 2 remastered kind of all at the same time. I think they finished the remastered just before it came out before Deserts. Like, I think it came out in 15 and Deserts came out in 16. But they were pretty much all guns blazing. And, you know, it was pretty intense Homeworld couple of years for us all.
And it's kind of great that, you know, people can play it all on the modern systems as well.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering as well, what happened with the expansion, Cataclysm? It came out as Emergence, and I heard it was because there was like some missing source code or something.
Yeah, I don't really remember what the deal was with that. I mean, Cataclysm was made back in the day by Barking Dog Studios, and when Gearbox acquired the IP, I think they had some kind of trouble finding all the source data for that game. But yeah, I don't know what happened with that. I think they finally did get their hands on it or something. But yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then kind of renamed it. But it is out on GOG, which is really good to see.
I was
wondering what's been your favorite experience working on the Homeworld series then? Is there anything that really stood out for you?
I could wax nostalgic about the making of the game and the incredible experiences with Paul Ruske and Aaron Kambitz and the Homeworld team back at Relic. But, you know, to be honest, I think now looking back from today, I'd probably have given you a different answer if you'd asked me that question, you know, 10 years ago. But today, I think my favorite part of the whole experience is the feedback that I've had from fans in the years since. And some of the letters people have written about how the game touched them or affected them and their lives or their choices. And, you know, it's really hard to put into words how touching it is when you, I mean, all we're talking about here is a silly video game, you know, but, you know, some people, it really touched them and they were deeply grateful and they're just very articulate. And, you know, some went on to become, you know, astrophysicists. Others got involved in video games themselves or narrative design. You know, there was one guy who said that it completely redefined his experience as a Jew in growing up in his family because of the Jewish Holocaust story. So he had, you know, the genocide theme that was going on in Homeworld, you know, really, you know, impacted him personally quite a lot. And he said it changed the way he understood his parents and grandparents. I mean, you know, things you would never, ever imagine, you know, at the time, you know, come to pass. And I think that's, you know, and seeing other games, you know, replicate the style or, you know, people referencing their art, the art of Homeworld and, you know, amazing artists like Paul Chatterson, you know, doing riffs on it and stuff. I mean, that's all very touching, but I think the feedback from fans, that would be my favorite part.
That's a really nice answer. And obviously right now, I mean, you know, we're on the cusp of Homeworld 3 coming out soon. I don't know, there's NDAs and all that floating around, I imagine. But from what I've heard about it, I mean, you know, I've heard the scale of this game is tremendous, way beyond anything we've seen before. I mean, what can you tell us about Homeworld 3 then, and how's that coming on?
Well, I mean, okay, so the short answer is it's coming on great. And I think, I'm obviously super biased, so, you know, talk to someone else, but for sure. But in my opinion, it's, if not the most pretty, it's one of the most pretty science fiction things I've ever seen. I just love it. It just looks so cool. The art team at Blackbird have done such an incredible job, Carl and his team. It's definitely worthy just in terms of how it looks, how it sounds, how it plays. It's incredibly authentic to the IP. It's just oversaturated with Homeworld vibes and flavors. You know, fans familiar with the franchise are just gonna love that. And I think new fans are gonna be tasting it for the first time and loving it too. But yeah, the scale is massive. I mean, I've said before that, you know, the spirit of Homeworld 3 was really born in the conception of Homeworld 2 in the early 2000s, but we were utterly unable to pull off that scale with the space terrain and geometry that we had in mind at the time. But now it's completely possible and it's happening in Homeworld 3. So, you know, without, you know, violating any disclosure agreements or letting any cats out of the bag, I can explain a little bit. Homeworld 3 is going to feature space geometry by way of, you know, artificial constructs like, you know, ancient hyperspace gates, but also in addition, you know, asteroid, you know, fields and ice fields and features in the 3D environment that will affect the flow of the game, the strategy game, and the distribution of resources in a really interesting way. So, you know, for the first time, you know, in a Homeworld game, you'll be able to exploit choke points, you know, like unit filtration areas where only small ships can pass through, but the big ships have to go around. You'll be able to deploy, you know, various units that are terrain specific or deal with the terrain in the gameplay in specific ways. You'll be able to fly inside the terrain and exploit cavities within the terrain for various gameplay wins like stealth and so on. So you've got the basic RTS sort of sandwich happening of, you know, resourcing, production, and combat. But it's now layered in to this three-dimensional geometry, the three-dimensional strategy game, and again, set against this spectacularly beautiful, you know, environment with a story that is a continuation of the story that is sort of left hanging at the end of Homeworld 2 with this discovery of this gate system in the galaxy. So it's super exciting. It feels wonderful to be working on it. And, you know, I really can't wait to get it into people's hands.
Oh, Rob, it sounds epic. I mean, are we still on course for a release first half of this year, do you think? Is that still happening?
I think you'd have to reach out to the Gearbox team for more specific release date information. But what I can tell you is that it's going super well. We're super excited. And I really can't wait to hear what people think.
Well, Rob, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you. And thank you so much for spending some time to reminisce with us. And we can't wait to see the work that you and the guys have done on Homeworld 3. So best of luck with it. We can't wait to play it. Well, and thanks so much for coming on and being our guest.
Thanks so much. The pleasure is 100% mine. That was really fun. And thanks so much.